let them go. They sparked this modern day movement. They were the trans women who sparked the movement. And now they were erasing the T. So you are not to say LGBT, just LGB, LGB. So they took away the T. The next day, a news conference, trans people, straight people, LGBTQ people, all descended on this federal monument, and they knew what was at stake, the onslaught against this community. Right through to now, words matter. When wielded maliciously by the powerful, words can harm, even kill. That's why Texas Republican Congressman Keith Self's words, chairing a recent House subcommittee hearing, deserve special condemnation. Near the hearing's end, Self recognized the committee's newest, most junior member, Delaware Democratic Congressmember Sarah McBride, the first transgender person elected to Congress. Self purposefully misgendered her. He said, "I now recognize the representative from Delaware, Mr. McBride." To which McBride replied, "Thank you, Madam Chair." Misgendering him without missing a beat. Self was immediately challenged by Massachusetts Democrat Bill Keating. He said, "Mr. Chairman, could you repeat your introduction again, please?" Self said, "Yes. We have set the standard on the floor of the House, and I'm simply," Keating said, "what's that standard, Mr. Chairman? Would you repeat what you just said when you introduced a duly elected representative from the United States of America, please?" Self said, "I will. The representative from Delaware, Mr. McBride." Keating says, "Mr. Chairman, you are out of order. Mr. Chairman, have you no decency?" Keating added, "You will not continue with me unless you introduce a duly elected representative the right way." Self quickly adjourned the hearing. He attempted to demean McBride. His attempt to demean her was the latest abuse heaped on her since her November election win, flowing from Trump's constant incitement of anti-trans hatred to rally his MAGA base. Since Trump's inauguration, he's issued at least 8 executive orders and memoranda targeting trans people. Back in July 2023, we spoke to congressional candidate Sarah McBride, who anticipated the hostility if she were elected. She said, "Let the pettiness of these far-right wing politicians contrast with our focus on progress. Let their cruelty contrast with our compassion. Let the diversity of our humanity be more fully seen in the halls of Congress, and to help reinforce that trans people are part of the rich fabric of America, that we have something to offer, that we are talented, thoughtful, effective legislators," she said. Laws targeting transgender people are being debated in state houses nationwide. The latest data from Trans Legislation Tracker cites 738 bills, I think it's higher now, in 2025 pipeline. The number of such bills being introduced shot up exponentially in recent years. McBride explained the surge. She said, "Ultimately, these laws that seek to restrict access to medically necessary health care for transgender people are all part of a cruel and concerted agenda that's meant to distract from the fact Republicans have absolutely no policy agenda to address the needs of workers and families in this country. This is part of an ongoing strategy that the far right wing has attempted to utilize throughout generations, which is to seek to divide and conquer. Trans people are just their new target." There have been a number of lawsuits. Several have been successfully blocked. While the court battles proceed, the lives of transgender people are still at risk. Now is the time for organizing and unflinching solidarity so that facing rising authoritarianism, we don't end up, paraphrasing the anti-Nazi German theologian Pastor Niemöller, we don't end up paraphrasing him and saying, "First they came for trans Americans, but I said nothing. Then they came for me." And the place to hear the voices of people talking about their sexuality, talking about their politics, talking about their concerns way beyond their gender identity, because they're being reduced to only talking about that. It's in media. It's in that huge table that we all sit around. I wanted to end with just two quick stories. I know I have like 5 minutes. One is back in 2016, being at Standing Rock in North Dakota. because it was the largest gathering of indigenous people this country had seen in decades. It was the Standing Rock Sioux taking on the Dakota Access Pipeline, afraid that when it went under the Missouri River, the longest river in North America, it could pollute the all of the people, native and non-native, living downstream to the tune of tens of millions of people, and that it was a danger to everyone. You know, it was April 1st, 2016. That was an election year when Clinton ran against Trump. You know, in that year, environmental issues in the presidential debates were hardly raised, let alone DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline. Yet this historic gathering was happening. It started with the unofficial historian of the Standing Rock Sioux, LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, who would later die of cancer. But she said, you know, we have to take on this. We can't do it alone. Anyone who wants to come to help us fight the standoff at Standing Rock, I'll open my property and you can set up your teepees or your tents, whatever. And she thought a couple dozen people would come. She had enough food for them. Dozens came, then hundreds came, then thousands of people came. They set up one resistance camp after another. Democracy Now! Was out there at Labor Day weekend of 2016. We came late to it. We were reporting on it from New York, but then we got there. It was Labor Day weekend, an official federal holiday, and we saw a group of people moving to a property that they said was their sacred burial ground. It was a holiday. They were shocked that they were seeing bulldozers excavating this property that was being debated in court later that week. A judge was going to rule on whether the Dakota Access Pipeline could do this, the company. And so they ran to the site. There were the bulldozers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We were running after them. We had our microphone and camera to record what was happening. It was kids. It was older women. It was older men. It was boys. They came up on the site, and they stood in front of these bulldozers. This is earth-crushing, major bulldozers. Their lives were clearly threatened by this, but the bulldozer operators didn't want to threaten their lives, so they started moving back, one bulldozer after another, and the people went forward, and amazingly enough, with hundreds of people, the bulldozers were pushed back. That meant the security of Dakota Access Pipeline came out with dogs to stop the retreat. They came out with dogs, and we just kept filming. They were biting the indigenous people, the allies. We filmed a dog with his nose and mouth covered in blood. They were denying that they were macing people, which they were. People were coughing, people were running, but people were moving forward. And eventually, even the security guards pulled their dogs away. The tractor drivers, they all pulled away. So we had this incredible footage, and we posted it online. You know, when I go into the networks, MSNBC, CNN, when I've been invited in, I say, why don't you deal more with the climate issue? And they say, we want to, the host would say. But our executives say, you know, people's eyes would roll. Well, people aren't interested. Within 24 hours, there were 14 million views of this video. We went back to New York. The judge was going to rule on Friday. Well, Friday we did the show, and then Nermeen Sheikh and I, co-host on Democracy Now!, went up to Toronto. I wasn't fleeing. It was the Toronto International Film Festival. There was a film on I.F. Stone, and they featured Democracy Now!, and so we were invited to speak after. But on Thursday, they issued an arrest warrant for me. For me, we were just filming. And again, I wasn't fleeing to Canada. I didn't know they'd issued the arrest warrant. So we spoke after the film, and the next day, University of Toronto had invited me to speak. And so I was speaking. All of a sudden, I always have my phone with me. I get on my phone, it says, you're under arrest. I thought, oh my God, one of the students has hacked my phone. Like, this is supposed to scare me or whatever. Okay, this is a joke. But I see it's a North Dakota number, so I'm not so sure. And I don't want to say it out loud. This is really serious. And so I just said, could someone call me a cab? I thought I'd race to the airport. And if I could get across back to the United States before the warrant goes into the system. And so I came back to the United States, and it was true. They'd issued an arrest warrant. And we thought, think of all the young reporters who want to cover this epic showdown. They're going to be afraid. If reporters are getting arrested, they're not going to go. And we have to show them this is what the corporate media has to do also. We will stand up for freedom of the press. Showing what is taking place. I knew that when we crossed, if they, you know, if you encounter FBI or Border Patrol or police, you could be in trouble if there's a warrant. But if we didn't, so I said, we're going back to North Dakota. We're going to take on this, what? They are threatening to arrest me? So as we flew back into North Dakota, as we are landing, my North Dakota lawyer, not that I had one before, called and said, as we got on the tarmac, they've dropped the charges. You know, this is embarrassing for them. They brought more serious charges. They're charging you with a felony. I said, I don't understand. If I were to serve time, how long would it be? He said, like maybe a year. I said, a year? I came here for like 3 days. Oh my God, when do I have to turn myself in or when will I be arraigned? And he said, Monday. It was Friday. I said, okay, we have 2 days to cover the protests. We've got a lot to get done. And we, on that morning, we broadcast right across from the courthouse so I wouldn't be late. It's the courthouse and the jail and the Ten Commandments in between. That was what it looks like in Mandan, North Dakota. So who did we interview? We interviewed the chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux at the time, Dave Archambault. I asked him, did you ever get arrested? There was some self-interest here. I wanted to know what would happen to me. And he said, yes. He said right early on, because they were so involved with civil disobedience. He was the chairman. He was like the president. He was the 45th, I think, chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux. And I said, what happened? And he said, well, they stripped me. And they put me in an orange jumpsuit, and I was jailed. And then I interviewed Dr. Sarah Jumping Eagle. She's the pediatrician of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. She cared about the health of the children if this pipeline were to go through. She was one of the first to be arrested. I said, what happened to you? Same, stripped, put in an orange jumpsuit, and jailed. How much humiliation can a people take? And so this was now getting a lot of attention. We finished the broadcast. Hundreds of people now came. Many indigenous people came. They were standing there along the line of our broadcast truck, and I was going to have to cross the street. And then I got a call from the North Dakota Public Radio, longtime host, knows every player and every scene here, and he says, the judge isn't going to do it. He's not going to sign the warrant against you. There's too much attention here. This is too hot. I mean, the New York Times, the BBC, Al Jazeera, Vogue magazine was covering this, and I didn't think I merited that, but this is why it was interesting. When the media shines a spotlight in the right direction, it wasn't just me that got off that day. There were a number of indigenous Native American people who were going to court, and their charges were dropped too. When the media sheds the spotlight in the right direction, that's what all of our goal is, to keep those microphones open, because when they are exposed to the light of day, that's when justice happens. My two final stories are Mamie Till Mobley, this remarkable woman who, after her son Emmett Till, in 1955, she sent him to be with his aunt and uncle in Mississippi to get out of the Chicago heat and to get away from the city to be safe. He's with his cousins and his aunt and uncle, and he's dragged out of his bed in the middle of the night by a white mob, and he is tortured and shackled to a weight that ends up in the bottom of the Tallahatchie River. They said he wolf-whistled at a white woman. When his body was dredged up and sent back to Chicago, Mamie, his mother, this remarkable, fierce fighter, said, I want the casket open, you know, his horribly distended, mutilated head. I want the casket open for the wake and the funeral. She wanted the world to see the ravages of racism, the brutality of bigotry, and thousands passed by his casket and saw. Mamie Till Mobley And Jet magazine took pictures and published them, and they were seared into the history and consciousness of this country. Mamie Till Mobley had something very important to teach the press of today. Show the pictures, show the images, broadcast the voices. Whether we're talking about the ravages of racism, the brutality of occupation, whether we're talking about U.S. troops deployed on the streets of the United States, immigrants taken in the middle of night, students having their visas revoked before they know it, learning of it as they're being arrested. When you see these images, you will say no. And I believe this of people across the political spectrum. It is critical that we expose what is happening. Stay away from the pundits. Go right to the people who are most affected, and only telling their stories if they can't tell their own, if they've been taken, if their livelihoods are threatened. Which brings me at the end to the White Rose Collective, to a remarkable brother and sister named Hans and Sophie Scholl, back to World War II. Hans was a medical student at the University of Munich. Sophie was his little sister. She was a college student at the University of Munich. They weren't Jewish. They were German Christians. But they thought, what can we do in the face of the Nazi atrocity? And together with professors and other students, they decided that they would unleash a series of pamphlets so the Germans would never be able to say we didn't know. And they issued 6 pamphlets in full. And one of those pamphlets said at the top, "We will not be silent." They distributed these everywhere. In the cover of night, they would drop them in an alley at a marketplace, throw them over the atrium of the University of Munich, so all these pamphlets would flutter in the wind down to the ground. Hans and Sophie and their professor were caught. They were charged, they were tried, they were convicted, and they were beheaded. But that philosophy, that motto, should be the Hippocratic Oath of us journalists today, should be Hippocratic Oath of us all today. We will not be silent.
How do you suggest that we tell these stories when it feels like they have no qualms with killing us? You know, how do we show compassion? How do we still stay professional? How do we still give these stories out and tell the whole story and really appeal to these people who, quite frankly, don't see us as human?
Well, I so appreciate your question. It's so important. You have to stay safe, that is for sure. I think what's important is that it is more than you, that you have a team of people, and the more you broadcast the voices of the community, that whole community rallies around you. You are definitely not alone. That's the power of community media. I've always found how amazing it is. You never can predict how people actually feel, that they respond to others telling their own truths, and it just so transcends politics. And you just have to forge forward, making sure that you are being fair, you're being accurate, you're seeking out people telling their stories. If you're telling someone's story because somehow they can't tell it, that it is well sourced. And but I will not minimize that it is a very frightening time, right? You have President Trump, after the assassination attempt against him, he gave a rally where he said, you know, I have glass here, plexiglass, he said, that protects me, but I can see if you took a direct shot here, you could hit the press right there. Ask, what are you talking about? And so I don't minimize the danger. I also think that I always think of what Isabel Allende, the great writer who wrote House of the Spirits, and I just interviewed for her latest book about another time in Chile. They have their September 11th, 1973, when the democratic leader Salvador Allende died in the palace as the Pinochet forces came to power. Unfortunately, the U.S.-backed Pinochet forces. But it was a coup decades before, similarly, fascism flourishing there. Isabel has always said, there are more of us than there are of them. For every thug in a community, there are 100, there are 1,000, there are 10,000 compañeros and compañeras who are there deeply caring about the community. It's not a matter of Democrat or Republican, or it's a matter of being human. And I think we have to express that humanity on the air. But I don't minimize your fear, but you're here for a reason, and you have important stories to tell and to let the community tell.
What role do you believe radio journalism and independent media play, not only in reporting on fascism, but actively resisting it? Thinking back to the legacy of Radio Venceremos in El Salvador, and where is the line between reporting and resistance, and when do you believe it must be crossed? Thank you.
This is a time when institutions are shutting down. They are, the public space is shrinking. And this is the time when community radio can shine. Someone can just hear a voice on the radio and pull over to the side of the road. And that touches not only that person, but the person they tell and the person they tell. It is old-fashioned in a sense. But, you know, every media outlet is now global. It's both community, but online it's global.org. And I think just doing that work is about resistance. I just came from New York. You know, there was a run of Good Night and Good Luck with George Clooney and Alana Glazer, and the amazing story, the telling the story of Edward Murrow and taking on the Red Scare. We are not alone in this country. All of us are speaking to people all over the world all the time. We probably have more in common with each other than we do perhaps with our governments. And really looking at places, I think of Maria Ressa, right? She won the Nobel Peace Prize for her journalism, taking on Duterte in the Philippines. And she came in a few years ago. She came in recently too, but a few years ago, she told us about what was happening. She'd accused him of being a murderer. She had the evidence. She was really taking him on. Now he's sitting in jail, but that's beside the point, at The Hague. And his daughter is the vice president. Maria said, you know, when we walked out of the studio, she said, when I just told that story, it wasn't just a story about my country, the Philippines, and, you know, the authoritarian push of this president. This is a story for you to learn for your country, because this is what you may well see in the next few years. And, of course, she was prophetic. And that's also why it's important that we all be global. And this goes to your question, too. People are dealing with these issues all over the world. And to hear these voices, we learn from them. They're trying to erase history now. I remember when I was growing up, the librarians were very scared of the intertubes, you know, because I guess we call it the internet now. But very scared because they said, well, we always have to keep a paper copy. And I would say that's, you know, so old-fashioned. You know, digitally, it's much more also environmental. You're cutting down less trees. No, we always need a paper copy because you never know. They could change it. They could erase it. And that is what we are seeing. Did you know in the last few weeks on the White House website, they have now removed all the transcripts of President Trump? Anything he said, this is the president. I'm not talking about grassroots movements. They said the only way you can best understand him is you have to listen to the video, the audio. They understood that because of the number of lies that are put out, you then have them very easily. Not that you can't transcribe it, but they're not going to make it easy for you.
And think about the universities, the grants people are writing. So many grants have been shut down. Science is so challenged now in this country, the whole investigation of the truth in every field. But it's critical that we have the record, as Robert F. Kennedy now, as health secretary, is erasing the knowledge base on everything from vaccines to cancer research to Alzheimer's. He just ended the vaccine advisory board. And then all of those records get wiped away unless we actually have records of them. And I see radio as the oral history of this country, and how important is that be protected, but not only looking back, looking forward, and ever expanding that range of voices that we bring people.
You were just listening to Amy Goodman on the power of community media. She spoke in Salt Lake City in mid-June 2025. Amy Goodman is the award-winning host of Democracy Now!, the daily syndicated radio and TV program. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Claudia de la Cruz, Vijay Prashad, Peter Beinert, Angela Davis, Gabor Mate, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Amy Goodman on the Power of Community Media, and for Noam Chomsky's classic book, How the World Works, call us 1-800-444-1977. Or go online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Thelonious Monk, straight, no chaser.
Serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, welcome to Forbes Avenue. I'm Rihanna Duncan, and today I have Rachel Curry here with me. So specifically what I'm going to be talking about with you today is that you are a freelance journalist. So how did you go from, like, just an English major to actually working in news?
Yeah, so I attended the University of Delaware, and there I majored in English and minored in journalism. There was no journalism major at the school I attended, but I had the opportunity to spend some of my free time writing for the campus newspaper, specifically the lifestyle slash arts and entertainment section, which was more up my alley at the time. And it was a lot of fun, and it enabled me to, get exposed to different parts of campus life that I otherwise would not have. I also joined a literary publication club called Main Street Journal. And I know that people who are listening in aren't familiar with maybe the University of Delaware's ins and outs, but it was basically poetry, some short stories, photography, a lot of cool stuff. And I ended up being the editor-in-chief of that my senior year. And that gave me some experience just kind of putting something together and seeing a finished product, which was really rewarding. And I still have all of those books, which is really cool. Throughout my undergraduate experience, I feel like with a lot of creative people, you face older folks saying you should maybe take a little bit more of a conservative route to ensure that you're going to be financially stable in the future. And I was always balancing that. It was really difficult for me to figure out what avenue I wanted to head in. But I also know that I personally did not want to make my passion of more creative writing into a career, because I felt like it was going to drain me. So I ended up applying for a role as a copywriter right out of college, and I worked there for a year, and it gave me an opportunity to live in a new place and experience living on my own and not having the support of my community necessarily right around me, which I think was a good experience. It was also a really cool company and had a lot of interesting benefits like workout classes and things like that, pretty modern. However, I just did not feel fulfilled at the end of the day, and I ended up leaving that job after a year on good terms, but I had used that time to save up some money and ended up going traveling in Southeast Asia for about a year after that. And I did that partly because I wanted to travel with my partner, but also partly because it was like an affordable place to live and I could get some life experience before I had some like gnarly responsibilities. I also at the time had heard of this platform called Fiverr, which I'm not sure if you're aware of, but it allows you to post your services on a freelance basis and people can buy them. And I know that some people are graphic designers selling logos to companies and things like that. I was really just writing, landing pages for people, sometimes blogs for their travel blogs and websites. So I started doing that while I was traveling, and honestly, just working on a tablet with like a little Bluetooth keyboard on a train or something. And it honestly kept me going. And by the time I came back, I wasn't necessarily like thriving financially, but I had at least more money than when I left. So I did seek full-time employment upon returning, but by that point it was getting close to the pandemic and things were a little crazy in the world. So I just kept trucking, kept going at my freelancing thing. And I ended up deciding to pursue it full time. So I formed an actual business, an LLC around that time, and decided to stop looking for a full-time employment and just keep going with the freelancing. And for a while, it was a mix between local journalism with some local publications and lifestyle magazines in my area of South Central Pennsylvania, and a lot of content writing clients, which differs from journalism in that it's more branded and you've got some bias in there. You're trying to support the company that pays for it. Then I was offered the opportunity from a former professor of mine, Ben Yagoda, who is also an esteemed author. And he, while retired, was still hosting study abroad trips for journalism students from the University of Delaware. And I had attended one of his study abroads back in like 2016. He invited me to be a teacher's assistant for that trip. And despite the fact that I'm not a graduate student and never have been, I do have industry experience, at least about, I've done some travel writing and things like that. And that's what it was focusing on. It was based in Melbourne, Australia. So I went with him and did that. And teaching students the fundamentals of journalism and just getting back out there and experiencing, I guess, that idea of why I enjoyed it in college actually really inspired me to get back into it and focus less on branded content writing for companies. And it basically pushed me to make a big pivot and do more serious journalism. So for the past couple of years, that's what I've been doing. I was blessed to be able to go to Australia for this trip twice in a row, which was really exciting. And meet a couple of wonderful group of students and spend some time with them. And now, yeah, I write a lot about technology because that's always changing in the world. I write about local issues in my community and various other new subjects that land in my lap.
Awesome. So you said you write about technology. You also write about finance. You have a book about investing sustainably, apparently. How did you go from focusing on like more lifestyle content, like you were doing in college, to focusing on finance and tech?
Yeah. So as someone who's always been creative minded, my younger self would be completely surprised to see where I am today, but I think it's a good transition. I got really interested in finance when I went all in on freelancing. And the reason why is because I realized like, oh, I have to figure out how I'm going to save for retirement. And I don't have a company who's just allowing me to put money in to a 401k and forget about it. I actually have to make sure I'm doing this on my own so that way I'm not flailing in 40 years. And that doesn't sound super exciting, but in today's media landscape, I was able to find a ton of podcasts that I would listen to just when I'm walking my dogs. There was one in particular, the early episodes of Bad with Money, which is kind of who I was at the time. And I learned literally the basics of what the heck is a stock. And moving from there, I completely transformed my mindset in like a matter of a year or so. And I'm still learning, of course. There's so much complexity to the landscape, but I ended up getting connected with a couple of investing platforms who needed blog content for their sites. And I continued to learn more through my research. And then I started doing some journalism for publications relating to the financial industry. And the cool thing about journalism is that you become an expert by talking to other experts. And so half of my job is just coming up with questions and asking questions to people who really know what they're talking about and translating that for the general public. So it's kind of a win-win for me where I get this clip, but I also get to learn about really cool stuff that people are working on day in and day out. Now with the sustainable investing endeavor, that's just something I kind of do as a little bit of a passion project. And the reason why is because I'm always interested in bettering the world in some way. And I don't mean to sound like a martyr of any kind, but I think if we can prioritize our investments to decentralize things that we don't want to propel in the world, and instead focus on things that we think will help sustain a healthy planet and healthy people for longer, then why not do that? And you can still profit by doing so. And also with the investing for the environment stuff, I've given talks in my local community, like the neighborhood that I live in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, has a climate action committee. And I've given a talk to them, and I've given a talk to my co-working space. So it's a pretty neat opportunity to just get to know people on a different level.
Wow. What would you say are the pros and also the cons of being freelance?
This is something that I'm always thinking about. The pros, number one, is flexibility in your day-to-day schedule. I consider myself more of a fast writer than some people might consider themselves. And because of that, I'm able to finish my work and maybe go to the gym later in the day before my partner gets home from his 9-to-5, or finish my work and I think this afternoon I'm going to go to the SPCA and like spend a couple hours with the dogs there, which is something I like to do. And that's been a huge game changer for me. And I guess I'll use this opportunity to say that the hard and fast corporate life that you think you're facing post college isn't actually healthy for people of certain mindsets, in the sense that we all struggle with our mental health, and I think that comes first, and being able to prioritize my mental health and still make a living has been a huge game changer in my life. Now, a couple other pluses to that is that I don't have to wait for necessarily a promotion and a raise or an annual bonus in order to restructure my finances. I can upscale my clientele, whether it's writing for a larger, more nationally oriented publication like CNBC, or shifting the type of work that I do to something that I think aligns more with what I hope to achieve in the long term. With that said, most of my clients are, at this point, people I've been working with for years, but there are a few slots of available client space that I have that I am able to kind of rotate over time and shift the work I do to better align with the economy and what I hope to achieve in life. There are downsides, of course. Like, there are benefits that come with working for a company, literally benefits like healthcare. And right now I have to purchase that through the marketplace, even though I have a long-term partner who I own a home with. But because of the way America works, that I have to wait until I'm legally married to use his healthcare. So a lot of it is just logistics based in stuff that I can get past in life. I think that in the past, I would have said one of the downsides is that I work independently, which I like most of the time, but sometimes you want some community. But I'm very fortunate to now live in a place for the past couple of years that has a thriving co-working space and community. Like, before hopping on this call with you this morning, I sat down with a group of women from my co-working space, and we just chatted and caught up with each other and figured out what everyone's doing in their work and their life, and had some quiche, and it was great. Other than that, I honestly think that I worked for a company for 1 year out of college before transitioning to being self-employed, essentially, and seeing as how I've always been one to kind of buck trends and do things because I felt like they were the right thing to do, not because they were written in stone at school or something like that. It kind of makes sense that I'm here.
Yeah. So one thing that you also mentioned is that you write both for local publications and also for stuff on a much larger scale. What would you say is the difference between doing those two things?
There's a huge difference, but the fundamentals of journalism remain the same. For example, I write for my local daily, not all the time, but I used to cover municipal board meetings, which sounds riveting, I know, but it actually was a little bit interesting because I partnered on an investigative research when a township was seeking to halt library funding without informing residents. And so we were able to bring enough noise and attention to that, that they actually ended up reversing the decision because so many people made a fuss. And that was really interesting. Now, on the national level, I talk to more people from all over the world, and usually about topics that are really a little bit more than you'd find in a medium-sized city like I live in. For example, stuff that's going on in Silicon Valley, or stuff that relates to some sort of federal political landscape of some kind. And I think that the reason why I continue to do the local journalism and the regional journalism, it's not for the money. It's really to keep me grounded and connected with my local community, because when I'm covering, for example, I recently interviewed a new bookstore cafe owner who launched her business, and I got the opportunity to go there and sit with her and explore the space. And that's just not something you get to do for CNBC.
Yeah, that sounds like so fun. I also know that you won a 2024 Keystone Media Award for reporting on diverse businesses. Can you tell me a little about that one as well?
Yeah, so that was a surprise. I didn't know that my editor for The Burg magazine, a monthly publication out of Harrisburg, had sent in my article as part of a larger package that won that award. And it was one of those emails you receive and you're like, this feels like they didn't mean to CC me on this, which says a little bit about imposter syndrome, but that's a conversation for another day. When I eventually realized it was legitimate, I just felt like so excited, but also just really grateful that people are seeing and appreciating the work about all these really interesting, diverse businesses that are coming to the area. The particular piece that I wrote covered the grand opening of a cafe in Mechanicsburg outside of Harrisburg. And it is owned by the mother of a child with Down syndrome and is staffed completely by people with disabilities. And it was a really interesting place because they were not only prioritizing and advertising how friendly and diverse the staff is, but also just that it's a really cool place to sit and work or chat with friends, and it has great coffee and delicious food. So I enjoyed shedding light on that for sure.
How does versus reporting on businesses end up differing?
Copywriting is writing copy or words for companies' websites generally, at least in the modern age. In the past, it might have been brochures, pamphlets. There's also technical writers who write instruction manuals and all that good stuff. I personally worked for a company that required me to write landing pages for car dealerships around the country. So I knew so much about cars during that year than I ever had before. And it was actually like an interesting thing to learn about. And the cool thing about being a writer of any kind is that you get to research all kinds of stuff. You kind of become like this vortex of facts, and it's a really cool party trick. But being a journalist is more balancing the size of the story with different perspectives. You're providing hopefully a more unbiased perspective. Obviously there's going to be inherent bias in anything because of simply what we choose to include and who we choose to interview. But the idea there is to provide a more robust piece with different angles of perspectives that tells a bit more of the full story instead of just a puff piece or like an advertisement.
So what do you think are some current trends that you've noticed as you've been working in journalism?
One interesting trend that I've noticed recently is a lot of journalists are branching off and creating their own publications. Myself included, I have a newsletter where I'm covering some business topics that I haven't been able to pitch and place elsewhere. And it's just a place for me to be a bit candid and sometimes say curse words, which I think is more my vibe. But I also know that a lot of readers are becoming disillusioned with traditional media for whatever reason that may be. For example, when recent publications have made decisions about what they're going to publish based on the opinions of the billionaires that own those publications, it pushed a lot of subscribers out. And I know that a lot of journalists took advantage of that and were able to say, hey, you can sign up to my weekly or monthly newsletter and it comes right to your inbox. Maybe there's a payment or a subscription. Maybe there's tiers. Maybe it's based on ads. Maybe it's based on donations even. But generally, people are really intrigued and excited by, it seems, kind of grassroots journalism right now. I know that I just subscribed to a newsletter that is written by people in prison and gives us a perspective of a world that we often only hear about from the outside. And I'm looking forward to receiving my first edition of that to see what that's all about. There's also another publication I'm part of called More to Her Story, which talks about the trials and tribulations of people, women specifically, around the world, oftentimes refugees or people in third world countries who are struggling to even gain an education. And I think it's cool to follow these more niche publications because it gives us a deeper dive into those perspectives. And another thing that's changing with journalism, I will say that there is another kind of hesitancy with the media that is approaching the more we get into this new administration, and I'm not really sure where that's going to head. For example, I know publications like Politico have recently been evicted from their post in the Pentagon and replaced with, for example, Breitbart News. And I think that does scare people a little. It scares me, I'll be honest, but I'm looking forward to seeing where the journalists are able to finagle their way through and get the details about what's going on in our country.
Well, you said that a lot of journalists now have newsletters. Do you think this is kind of a response to the fact that like smaller publications have been on a decline for the past 20 years or so?
I think that it's not necessarily a response to that, but more of a rewriting of where media is headed. For example, most of, I don't know the exact percentage, but most of the local daily newspapers in the United States are owned by Gannett or Gannett. I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but it's Australian-owned media corporation, and it really has taken away the independence of a lot of these publications. And naturally, in the digital age, paper readership is down. That's just going to be the case. And that's okay, because there are so many avenues to get information to people digitally. A lot of people do still really want to read the written word, even if it's online, myself included. There's also a whole cohort of people who are voraciously consuming podcasts, also myself included. I'm not sure. Maybe I need to spend more time in quiet or something, but I like to consume media a lot. Then there's the people who are consuming news from oftentimes reputable reporters on TikTok. And this is just the nature of the modern age. I think that certain publications are slowly but surely coming around to that. Like, I know that the New York Times is creating more of a digital ecosystem than it ever has before. And when you subscribe to the New York Times, you get access to bonus podcasts on Spotify and things like that. So in one way, it's just the natural order of things. And I think it's pretty cool that reporters are kind of scaling down, being more independent, and really taking the power back into their own hands.
Yeah. What's one thing that you're most proud of what you've reported on?
Well, I recently published an article on CNBC that focuses on how digital hiring assessments that people often have to take in order to even get to an interview stage in a company are largely not accessible for people with disabilities, despite the fact that many of them say they are. And I was able to speak to people with various disabilities, people who consult on this issue, people who research this issue, and figure out maybe what the next step is and why we need to restructure the digital hiring process. The interesting thing about that is that the Americans with Disability Act is, well, this year will be 30 years old. It wasn't until the last couple of decades that we've been living vastly online, and hiring online is even more recent. So a lot of these problems that people face who have disabilities are actually newer, even though there is accessibility in a lot more ways than we maybe have known in the past. There's kind of new ways that we have to fight against bias as well.
That's so interesting. So what is the advice that you'd give to so a young person, maybe someone in college like me, who might be interested in going into journalism?
My advice is that even if you feel like you don't have the expertise to be reporting on something, just go for it anyway and ask a lot of questions. People get really excited when they're given the opportunity to answer questions, even if they might not seem like it at first. All you have to do is say, I'm a reporter, can I ask you some questions for such and such? Usually they let their guard down pretty quickly, even if there is a hesitancy at first, and it ends up working out really well. I would say, don't be afraid to push the status quo and ask the hard questions. I feel like a lot of the advice I'm giving is just don't be afraid. But despite the fact that the college experience gives you an opportunity to step outside of the box and try new things, there are ways that that opportunity may also try to confine you to pursue a certain path. And you really don't have to do that path if you don't want to. You can choose your own. And there's more options now than ever. You can work fully online. You can work remote from a post in Bali if you want. You don't have to do that forever, but I think it's, you know, after college, it's always a good time to try something like that. So I'll just say, you know, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. My name is Rachel Curry. I'm pretty active on there. I do have my newsletter called Acronym, which I'll be posting about all the time. And if you feel like you have a lead for a story, feel free to send me a message.
Thank you. So yeah, this has been Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Rihanna Duncan, and I've been interviewing Rachel Curry. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
You are listening to The Sound of Language on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
Great. So today our guest is Simona Körner. I was going to ask you to teach me how to pronounce your name correctly.
You met it pretty well.
Okay. Yes. So we met on the first day of grad school, and we became fast friends. And I wanted to invite Simona because we met up this past weekend in Princeton at a conference called Fantasies of the People. And Nick was also there. And because of that opportunity of you coming to this country, Simona and Nick came from Germany. I thought it would be really nice to be able to spend some time together and then for Simona to be able to share their performance practice and the work that they've been doing recently with field recordings with you all. One of the things that I feel really connected with you about with your practice is how research-based it is. And with research, it expands beyond reading, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of research that is about connecting with people. It's very embodied. And in your performance work, you talk about this, right? And you enact it. And I wanted you to come and be able to share that with us.
Yes, thank you for inviting me. So interesting because we already talked about that in the car a bit, that I have the feeling I was like so in a kind of way anxious to come here and talk about my practice because so much changed in the last weeks, like politically, mm-hmm. And not just because of like telling or speaking out mm-hmm. about political things, but also because I have the feeling my artistic practice needs to necessarily change through that, or I have to like regain it, and like it's like